We're talking about the aftermath of an aircraft maker bankruptcy and what the falling apart of a business deal means for Superior and the state as a whole. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 6 years ago, Kestrel Aircraft came to Superior promising hundreds of manufacturing jobs, but the jobs didn't materialize. And after loans and legal actions and now bankruptcy, we're getting up to speed on what happened in this piece of economic development that turned sour. How do you feel about companies that promise jobs in Wisconsin but don't deliver? What could Superior and the state do differently in brokering deals like this? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Danielle Kading is a reporter for WPR News based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Thanks, Kate.
So before we get into the back and forth of the business dealings here, who is Kestrel Aircraft?
Kestrel Aircraft Company was basically developed by Alan Klapmeyer, who is the CEO of the company, and he also co-founded Cirrus Aircraft in Duluth.
And what do they do?
The company has been trying to make parts, and it's build its turboprop Kestrel 350. It's a single-engine jet, and they've been trying to develop that for years through FAA certification.
And so city and county leaders there were providing loans to Kestrel. What was this business deal? What was going on?
Yeah, so in 2012, Kestrel said that they would create 600 jobs in Superior, and it was a really big deal for the city. And so as part of that, Douglas County provided a $500,000 loan, and Superior put up around $2.6 million, along with the state, which put up state and federal loans worth $4 million through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And they also had the opportunity to get up to $90 million in tax credits through the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. And all of this was put together as an economic incentive package to create this plane manufacturing facility in Superior, create jobs. And it's turned out a little bit differently than what state and county and city officials would have hoped.
Right, because there has been litigation since then and an effort to try to get some of these loan dollars back. How likely is it that government officials in Superior will recover the money loaned to Kestrel?
Well, city and county officials are pretty doubtful that they'll be able to recover those costs and their investment in that project because, you know, as you mentioned, the company, One Aviation and Kestrel, have filed for bankruptcy. They did that last October, and they have a total debt of more than $198 million. And they owe $53 million alone to state and local governments. So there's a lot of people who are vying for a piece of the company's remaining assets.
So take us back to this point in 2012. Why did former Governor Walker want to bring Kestrel Aircraft to Wisconsin and do it perhaps pretty quickly?
Well, if you remember at the time, you know, Walker had been elected. He was in his first term and he had pledged to create 250,000 jobs as part of his first term as governor. And so as part of that, he was pursuing economic opportunities in the state, and he and the state worked with Kestrel, who at the time was working on a production project in Maine. And so at that time, the CEO of Kestrel, Alan Klapmeyer, said that, you know, things didn't look very certain for financing in Maine, so they decided to move to Wisconsin.
We're talking about government incentives for jobs in a case where jobs didn't actually materialize. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior. What do you think about Superior's deal with Kestrel Aircraft that went sour? How do you feel about job incentive programs? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Brian now, joining us from Superior. Hi, Brian. Are you there, Brian?
Take my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a retired federal
Oh, and you're really breaking up. You're gonna have to try to call back here. I'm so sorry. We can't understand. Danny, you spoke with Mayor Jim Payne, who called Kestrel the grandfather of the state's controversial deal with Foxconn. What type of comparison was the mayor drawing here?
Well, he basically was saying that it was all the same people involved, you know, city, county, and state officials, and they were crafting a deal based on the idea of government taking out, as he put it, massive amounts of debt to award massive amounts of upfront cash to a big corporation. The difference between Kestrel and Foxconn is that the state did not award upfront cash or upfront loans to Foxconn, although records show the electronics manufacturer did seek around $1 million in upfront payment. But the state rejected that in favor of going with an agreement where the company would have to reach benchmarks on construction and hiring in order to earn that money that was awarded.
So Kestrel owes $53 million to state and local governments, $3 million to Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Have we heard anything out of Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation about this incentive package and what happened?
Basically, they are saying that they're trying to recover the loans that they awarded to Kestrel, those that remain to be paid through the bankruptcy process.
And Kestrel officials have said that they hope to emerge from bankruptcy. Do we know yet how they plan to do that or how these bankruptcy proceedings are going?
Yeah, so One Aviation Corporation, which is the parent company of Kestrel, is working right now on a deal with City King, which is a lender related to Kestrel. And basically, through this deal, it would enable the company to stay afloat, and they would be other entity would honor the debts under a settlement agreement through the courts. Mm. So they're hoping to go that route. But the acting U.S. trustee in the case has motion to dismiss the company's Chapter 11 reorganization plan in favor of Chapter 7 liquidation. Huh. And what all of that means is that the trustee could sell Kestrel's assets to pay those who are owed money, which is not a favorable option for the company.
We have time for just a quick call here. Scott in West Bend. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Yeah, just wanted to say I find it amazing through the Walker funding for all these businesses. We had a Ultralight aircraft company in Fond du Lac that if they were going to put together did the same thing. They should have an epic economic development for taxpayers that don't own businesses. You want to be an entrepreneur, create a business, that's great. But you shouldn't ask the taxpayers to pay for it. A lot of stores do this, even like Walmart. They rent their stores. They don't own them. So when they have chemical spills, the DNR has to pull teeth to get them to clean it up, or they won't clean it up.
Scott,
we just need to give the taxpayers a break.
Scott, thanks for calling in. Danny, what are you watching for as this case unfolds?
Well, the bankruptcy proceedings are ongoing, and we'll just kind of wait and see how that pans out and whether that means people will be paid the money they're owed.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is a reporter for WPR News based in Superior. Coming up, Wisconsin authorities moved Jamie Kloss's kidnapper to an out-of-state prison. We'll talk with a reporter about public access to inmate records. Back in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learned recently that the man who kidnapped Jamie Kloss and murdered her parents has been moved to a prison in New Mexico. A judge sentenced Jake Patterson to life in prison in May. But a reporter tracking down this prison transfer, it was a process. And we're talking about public access to inmate records. What do you think about state authorities moving Jamie Kloss's kidnapper out of Wisconsin? Should people convicted of crimes here in Wisconsin be kept here? We're at 800-642-1234. Haley B. Miller is a reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette. Haley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you learn that Jamie Kloss's kidnapper, Jake Patterson, was moved to New Mexico?
I had been hearing some rumors about it, and then I ended up calling their corrections department, not speaking to any official spokespeople because those folks wouldn't confirm for me, but just ended up chatting with someone very briefly who was able to look him up and find him in their system. But even now, if you search him on New Mexico Corrections website, he still does not show up despite the fact that we know he's there.
And so we don't even know which prison in New Mexico he's being held at.
Correct. Yeah, I still have not found that out.
What have Wisconsin authorities said about moving Jake Patterson? You know, why? What was the justification here?
They decided to move him for security reasons, and that's about all they've said. I spoke before he was transferred. I spoke with our former corrections secretary, who made the observation that, you know, with high profile cases like this, sometimes other inmates more or less want their 15 minutes of fame, want to be seen as the person who maybe did something to someone else. So I'm guessing that was the ultimate concern because of the nature of the case and how widespread it became.
So you reviewed a copy of Jake Patterson's inmate report. Does it suggest he was attacked in prison or his safety was at risk?
There's nothing in there along those lines, no. The only references to him being moved, there's a recommendation in there that says that he should be moved because of the high profile nature of the case, and that was about all the report said.
Talking with Haley B. Miller, she's a reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette. She joins us talking about Jamie Kloss's kidnapper being moved to an out-of-state prison in New Mexico. What questions do you have about Jake Patterson? How do you feel about corrections authorities transferring him to another state? Join in at 800-642-1234. Haley, Wisconsin authorities removed information, as you said, about Patterson's location from online state records. Do you know if Patterson's victims or his family are still able to know his location, to be able to get in touch with him?
I'm not aware of what the family knows at this point. The Department of Corrections did make the point to me that, you know, crime victims are able to sign up for notifications about where a particular offender is. So it's certainly possible that the family has done something along those lines. But in terms of publicly available information, he is still not on the department's offender search. He is back on the state sex offender registry.
When you say he's back on, was he off for a while? You know, was he off for a while?
It was kind of strange. So if you searched for a brief period of time, if you searched directly on the state sex offender registry, he would not show up. But if you searched him through the federal registry, you could, you know, click a few things and eventually find him. But so the direct search on the state website is back now, but that was, you were unable to do that for a brief period of time.
What do advocates for open government say about authorities, Wisconsin authorities, keeping Jake Patterson's location confidential?
They're concerned. You know, I talked to someone from the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council who, you know, had some very strong words about this. He said that, you know, hiding inmate information is what, you know, dictatorships do. I mean, making the point that in the United States, you know, people are not imprisoned secretly. So there are definitely concerns about the fact that the public, at least right now, is still unable to track his location.
Do we know if Jake Patterson will serve his life sentence in New Mexico? Could there be another transfer here?
There very well could be. It's hard to say at this point. I would guess that he'll at least be in New Mexico for the foreseeable future. But down the road, I mean, he has a lot of life ahead of him, so it is possible that he could be transferred again at some point down the road.
Why is it important for people outside the Department of Corrections community? Why is it important for us to know where prisoners are held, are kept?
You know, I think there's a bit of an accountability there, you know, on behalf of our government officials, you know, knowing what happens to criminals that, you know, officials decide to put into our state correction system. You know, as a bill from the Freedom of Information Council pointed out, you know, it is a privilege in the United States that, you know, information like this is readily available. And, you know, when it's not, it does beg several questions about, you know, the motivation for, you know, why they're hiding it. And, you know, who they're trying to protect and all of it.
Oh, so it could be a slippery slope that if you withhold information about where a prisoner is kept, it perhaps would lead to withholding other information about life inside of a prison.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you can't track where a person is, you have no sense of what could possibly be happening to them in the prison, what those prison conditions are like. So, yeah, exactly.
For inmates like Jake Patterson, is there a significant security risk inside prisons based on the crimes he's committed and what other inmates will think of those crimes?
You know, I do think because his case was so high profile, I mean, particularly in Wisconsin, but even nationwide, you know, when there is a crime against a child in some way or another, I do feel like there is added emotion there that could make a prison situation more dangerous, if nothing else, because, you know, as our former corrections secretary said, some inmates, you know, could maybe be one of seen as a hero for, you know, hurting someone like this. I mean, look what happened with Jeffrey Dahmer. So, you know, that definitely does pose a security risk for him, likely.
Haley, since Jake Patterson was sentenced in May for kidnapping Jamie Kloss and killing her parents, have we learned anything new about him or his crimes?
We have not learned anything new about him. You know, right now, the Department of Justice is in the process of working with local law enforcement agencies to determine what records from the case can be released now that he's been sentenced. As you can imagine, throughout the proceedings, they were hesitant to release much of anything. So now there's a review of those records happening. So once those are able to be released to the public, some more details about his crimes may come out. But at this point, it's pretty much everything that we learned during the criminal proceedings.
What about Jamie Kloss? Have we learned more about her or her recovery?
The last that I heard, she, you know, was continuing to be in therapy. I actually just saw some news reports this morning that I have not been able to confirm independently, but some reports that the home where she lived with her parents has been demolished. But she continues to live with her aunt and uncle, and, you know, I suspect is just trying to regain some sense of a normal life after the tragedy that she endured.
Very quickly here, will you continue to keep tabs on Jake Patterson's whereabouts in prison?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to find out which facility he's in and, continue to monitor that and see, see what, if anything, happens while he's incarcerated.
Haley, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Haley B. Miller is a reporter for the Green Bay Press-Gazette. Coming up, we talk with a cardiologist about new guidance for aspirin. Do you take aspirin daily or only in certain situations? What questions do you have about an aspirin-a-day regimen? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back after this news update, stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about aspirin and new guidance about taking it. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. A recent study out of Harvard found that an estimated 29 million people who are age 40 and older were taking an aspirin a day despite having no known heart disease in 2017, and that's the latest data available. Millions were doing it on their own without a doctor's recommendation. So do you take a daily aspirin? And if so, why? Did your doctor recommend it? Or was this a decision you made for yourself? If you're not a daily aspirin taker, use it occasionally. What do you use it for? Pain relief? Something else? Join in at 800-642-1234. Cardiologist Steve Kopetsky is with the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's also a past president of the American Society of Preventive Cardiology. Dr. Kopetsky, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
So can you explain for us what aspirin is and how it works?
That's a good question. Because it's really one of the oldest drugs we have. It's been around for over 100 years, and it appears that it blocks platelets. Platelets are little cells that clot. They're about one-seventh the size of a red blood cell. And when there's a damage to your lining of your artery, such as that occurs with high cholesterol or high blood pressure or smoking, sometimes that damage will occur and it will tear the lining of the artery, and that's when the platelets go into action. They start to clot, they aggregate, there'll be billions of platelets in a single clot, and aspirin blocks that mechanism of the clotting of these platelets.
And that's kind of where this aspirin-a-day regimen came for people who had had a heart attack?
That's right. And it's been shown that if you've had a heart attack, it really is helpful for you if you have known heart disease, such as if you've had a stent or had a heart attack or have had arteries that have been bypassed in your legs or your up to your head. Then aspirin is very helpful.
It seems recently, though, there's been some confusion over taking aspirin. Do you have patients asking you questions about it?
Oh, all the time. And a lot of doctors ask questions, too, because the guidelines and the recommendations and the studies have changed over the years. We've assumed that it's been helpful for everybody, but we're finding that's not quite the case.
Well, yeah, over 100 years, you'd think we'd know quite a bit more about aspirin and exactly what it does.
No, that's a good point. And the thing with aspirin is that it's generic, it's free, almost, it costs very little. And if it was a very expensive drug that cost a lot of money, I think we'd have a lot of studies looking at it and deciding when do we use it, when do we not use it. But because the nature of aspirin, the cost of it's so low, that those studies really have not been done.
Okay, so in what situation is it okay to take an aspirin? Outside of this daily aspirin regimen and heart disease, on occasion, is it okay to take an aspirin?
Yeah, good question. So if you have disease, arteries that are narrowed, it's helpful to take it. Now, what if you don't? What if you just think you do? Or your brother had a stent, or your mother died about the same age of a heart attack that you are now? Then what we do is try to assess patient's risk. And it's a risk for both having a heart attack or a stroke and the risk for bleeding. And the reason that's important is as you go through life, your risk of heart attack and stroke goes up, which we all understand. But as you go through life, your risk for bleeding on aspirin goes up faster. So that just taking aspirin may not be that great of an idea because of the side effects, which are bleeding.
is how much aspirin is too much? Is there a real threat to bleeding and as you take a higher dosage?
Well, there is a threat, and there is an issue. Mainly it's in your gut. You can get gut bleeding. It's rare, but you can also get bleeding into your head. But those are the two main issues. Some people get what are called nuisance bleeds, that you cut yourself shaving and it, you know, you bleed for a little longer time. You have to hold pressure. Or bruising. That can be a real issue, especially with the elderly, is they walk through a door jam, they hit their arm on the door, they get a big bruise. And the dosage does seem to play a role. We recommend what's called adult low dose. We don't call it baby aspirin anymore because babies don't take aspirin. So we call it adult low dose, which would be 81 milligrams.
We're learning about aspirin and taking your questions along the way. Dr. Steve Kopetsky is a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. What questions do you have about aspirin? Are you a daily user? Why do you take it? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your stories. Dr. Kopetsky, why was aspirin prescribed to children to begin with, or why was baby aspirin around for so many decades? I remember it in my childhood. It tasted like orange flavor.
Right. Because really, it was the only thing we had for many years to treat a fever that was a pill, and it was really a miracle drug when it came out. I have understood that the name aspirin comes from the spirea plant, S-P-I-R, and it was originally actually manufactured by Bayer in Germany, and they're still the biggest seller of aspirin, at least in this country.
So Bayer still holds the market for aspirin. Is that market kind of leveled off, do you see, or are we finding new ways that aspirin might work for preventative health measures or other types of health measures?
Well, about a third of the population in general takes aspirin daily, the adult population. And so it's, when you think about it, that's a huge number of people taking one pill every day. What we've tried to do, though, is to risk stratify patients and talk to them about it. And there's phone apps, there's places online you can go on the American College of Cardiology. You can do a risk score, and it's called ASCVD Risk Plus. ASCVD stands for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, which is a fancy word for narrowing of the arteries. And you can look at your risk for having a heart attack or a stroke over the next 10 years. If the risk is over about 7.5% and you don't have any bleeding issues, meaning you haven't had bleeding problems in the past, then you consider going on the aspirin. If your risk is over 15%, we really do recommend that the aspirin be started. It's interesting that aspirin reduces first heart attack in men, but it doesn't reduce first heart attack in women.
Why is that?
Well, that's a good question. Men and women are equal, but they are very different physiologically. Men and women develop different narrowing of the artery, patterns of the narrowing of the arteries than the other one. Meaning that women develop disease in the blood vessels that go to their head in different places than men do. And so it's interesting that aspirin does prevent first heart attack, or first stroke, rather, in women, but it doesn't prevent first stroke in men. So you have to individualize. And if we have a woman who says, gee, my mother had a stroke about my age, should I be on aspirin? And we do a risk calculation. If it's high enough and she doesn't have bleeding issues, you know, talk to her about it and maybe suggest the aspirin, especially with the stroke issue. It's not the same in men. It doesn't really work that well for men for first stroke. But if a man is much more likely to have a heart attack, then we certainly would consider it for him. The other issue about aspirin is that it does seem to have benefit on reducing colorectal cancer. The thing about that, you have to take it for longer, maybe 5 to 10 years for it to reduce the cancer. But with heart attack or stroke, can reduce it much quicker.
Well, let's take a call now. Jessica joining us from Mequon. Hi, Jessica.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Doctor. How are you today?
Good morning. Very good. Thanks.
Great. So I have a question. I actually studied physiology in my undergrad and enjoyed it very much. And one of the things I remember that stuck with me is that aspirin is actually metabolized by the kidneys as opposed to the liver, like many other things are. And so I wonder what you think about occasionally taking aspirin, you know, at any stage of life as an adult, just to give your liver a break, if that's a reasonable way to use aspirin.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. The liver is an amazing organ that metabolizes almost all of our drugs, as you pointed out. The thing about the aspirin, and you can also put in that category the other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or naproxen, that it can affect the kidneys. And if you have kidney dysfunction or your kidneys don't work well, you have to be careful with these drugs that are that do affect the kidney, like any of these NSAIDs, as they're called, including aspirin. So I wouldn't do it to give your liver a break. I would be more concerned about your kidney. If your kidneys don't work well, I would shy away from just taking it randomly.
Thanks so much, Jessica. Let's go to Cindy now in Belleville. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Kate. Thanks.
Sure.
My question is about people with blood type A positive. I'm type A positive. My family, I have a strong family history of heart disease, and I have been taking an 81 milligram aspirin a day, and in light of this new study, I'm wondering now if that's still a good idea. I know that type A positive people tend to be high platelet people. I'm sort of a super clotter. I always clot very, very quickly. So wondering if that's still a good idea for me.
You bring up some very interesting points. The blood type does help determine your risk for heart attack, and that's not widely known. And we know that if you have certain genes, like for diabetes or for high blood pressure or high cholesterol, that increases your risk for heart attack. But just having a gene for type A blood increases your risk of heart attack by about 20% if you had an identical twin who had a different blood type. If you're type B, it also increases your risk for heart attack by about 20%. And if you're type AB, it increases it about 40%. So you're right, you are at a little increased risk for heart attack. Now, having said those numbers, lifestyle can overcome that. You know, if you have a bad lifestyle, your risk for heart attack goes up 400%, not just 40%. So with your question, the aspirin may be a good idea with you. I would certainly suggest doing a risk score, a risk score we talked about a minute ago. And if your risk is high, certainly the 15% range over the next 10 years, then aspirin may be a very good idea if you don't have bleeding problems.
We're talking with Dr. Steve Kopetsky, a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, talking about aspirin, how we use it. Are you confused about the changing guidelines on aspirin? What questions do you have about aspirin in general? Have you had a conversation with your physician about aspirin? How did it go? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about an aspirin a day regimen and the changing recommendations on taking aspirin. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Do you take aspirin? And if so, did that come from a physician recommendation? Join in at 800-642-1234. Mayo Clinic cardiologist Steve Kopetsky stays with us and answers your questions about aspirin. Dr. Kopetsky, Pete from Reedsburg shared over email that he has heard about aspirin working as a cancer preventative. What do we know about that link, if any, between aspirin and preventing cancer?
Yeah, good question. But it does seem to reduce colorectal cancer risk. So cancers that are in your colon, your large intestine, or your rectum. But you have to take it for a longer amount of time, usually up to a decade, before you can really see the benefit. Why that is not clear. Originally, it was thought that maybe it just caused a little more bleeding, so people went to their doctor for bleeding and they found the cancer earlier, but that's not really the case. It does seem to appear to reduce inflammation, which is what it does in the arteries, too. And inflammation can lead to blood clots, can lead to cancer, And so that's been the theory, that the reduced inflammation that occurs with that causes all these diseases is improved by the aspirin.
Let's bring in another call. Paul joining us from Wausau. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, my question is that I had a cardiac bypass surgery about a year ago, 52 years old, and was on Plavix and aspirin until last June. I was having some stomach problems and went off both. Do you see that being an issue?
If you've had bypass, you certainly have coronary artery disease, and it may be helpful to be on one of those drugs instead of both. I would certainly advise talking to your doctor about it. It was interesting that a study over 20 years ago called the Capri study compared aspirin alone to Plavix alone, or clopidogrel is the generic name, and actually found that the Plavix was a better drug than aspirin for inhibiting blood clotting, and it actually had less side effects. So what we're starting to do now is, in some patients that have problems with aspirin, we're actually just giving them the Plavix, the generic Plavix or clopidogrel. But, of course, that needs to be talked with your caregiver.
Paul, Paul, thanks so much for the call. Tom now in Eau Claire. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm calling from Eau Claire. I'm a 65-year-old male. I have emphysema, and they have set me in for a CAT scan and then a PET scan. That was in 2017. They came back that I have a growth on my left lung. Since then, I had two more, and they weren't sure if it was cancerous. Well, I had gone by the recommendation of my cardiologist, who also is probably a colleague of the doctor who's on the air right now, because he works
at Mayo.
Eau Claire.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mayo at Eau Claire. Anyway, it turns out that it was cancerous, and I had the tumor removed. That was on July 9th. But I had started a regimen, I guess, or taking aspirin through the cardiologist. How I got to him was my...
How long have you taken the aspirin regimen, Tom?
It's about 3 months now.
How is it going?
I'm taking two a day, baby aspirin. It seems to be working fine, but I'm curious to know under what circumstances, or I guess how truly bad my heart would be to take two baby aspirin a day.
Dr. Kopetsky, your thoughts?
Yeah, I can't. It's hard for me to comment on your specific. I would like to know. Our knowledge will evolve. I mean, that's what medicine is we try to learn every day and improve the care we give patients.
Dr. Kopetsky, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Dr. Steve Kopetsky is a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. He is also a past president of the American Society of Preventive Cardiology. We've been looking at new guidelines on using aspirin and the aspirin-a-day regimen. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.